call Senate State Affairs to order at 9:04 on 27 February. Present we have Senator Giesel, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilkowski will be here, and there's no excuse for Stedman, from Stedman. And it is my intention to have Senator Wilkowski's bill on registration fees, waiving them for National Guard, and Senate Joint Resolution 18, which is one of mine, has to do with the calling of a convention of the states proposing a constitutional amendment to the U.S. Congress, and we'll just get that introduced and so on. There's a companion bill in the House, and then we will hopefully pass out Senate Bill 182. I've committed to the folks who are here or interested that we'll at least have 45 minutes for that, and we have some folks online. We'll try to get everybody in and so on, and have asked some of the leadership here to make their presentation first. And then we had the bill on arming of BPSOs, and you'll see we have a couple of officers from the state troopers here. We didn't ask them to come for be bodyguards, but they'd be very capable, I suspect. So I'm going to start out with SGR 18. Tyler, are you out there? Yeah. Please be seated and introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Tyler Belk, staff for Senator Dyson. For the past 7 years, the United States federal government has operated outside of the constraints of what our founding fathers had envisioned. Inherent overspending, overextended use of regulation and enforcement jurisdiction, and unreasonably long service terms of federal government officials are a few of several ways in which our national government is moving outside of its design blueprint. Aiming to mitigate a federal government that exceeds its enumerated powers, our founding fathers added a key provision to the Constitution that would allow for the states to rein in and control any move to expand federal government beyond its intended means. Article 5 grants states the power to call for a convention of the states to amend the Constitution in a controlled and topic-specific manner. This ability to call for a convention is a method to rein in and alleviate the aforementioned problems. A convention of states is not a constitutional convention. The scope and subject matter of a convention of states is controlled and limited by what the applications call for. SJR 18 is the first step in a long process for a convention. Through the Article 5 process, two-thirds or 34 of the 50 states must call for a convention based on a similar application. Congress then must call for a convention once those applications are received. Delegates, which are chosen in a manner decided on by the states, will design and debate amendments aimed at a topic. In this case, imposing fiscal constraints on the federal government, limiting the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and limiting the terms of office officials will be the topic. If the convention validly proposes one or more amendments, Article 5 requires Congress to select one of two modes of ratification. Congress may decide that amendments be submitted to the states and the state legislatures, or they will demand that the states call for special amendment conventions within the states, similar to how we did with the 21st Amendment to repeal prohibition. SGR 18 is a portion of Step 1 of the Article 5 convention process. It is the state of Alaska's formal application calling for a convention of the states. Essentially, this resolution is Alaska moving into queue for an Article 5 convention.
Questions from the committee? Looks like, is anybody here in the room to testify on this? All right. We are not going to take action on this, but I see that Roy Carlson Wasilla is online. Can you hear us, Roy?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I can.
Yeah, be glad to have you speak at least briefly to this, and there'll be another bite of the apple when we schedule this resolution in the next probably a couple of weeks. But please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
My name is Roy Carlson. I'm a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel, Vietnam veteran. I'm 74 years old, and I am humbled by this opportunity. I do not intend my words to be partisan in any way. What I am saying has been going on for many years through different party administrations. The resolution before you is truly nonpartisan. During the Constitutional Convention, it was argued that the amendment process did not address the possibility of an out-of-control federal government. They recognized that Congress would not pass an amendment limiting their own power. So they added another way to amend the Constitution and put that power in the hands of state legislatures. That, of course, is your committee and your colleagues in the Alaska legislature. You have a necessary and awesome responsibility. As a soldier, I've seen tyranny. I've seen it in the eyes of the children who are not carefree and laugh when they are at play. You see it in the faces of their parents who are afraid for themselves and their children. They are afraid to talk to you for fear of reprisal by their government or terrorist groups. Also, I've talked to a number of immigrants from the former Soviet Union and Cuba and other countries with tyrannical governments, and with a unified voice, they say, wake up. Don't you understand what's happening to you? They see it because they've been through it. And for the sake of time, I won't list the litany of the issues today. Let me just say the federal government is out of control. And we know from history that a mere change of administration is not going to change that. And so I ask you to please pass SJR 18. Thank you, and thank you for the service to your state.
Thank you for your service to the nation, Roy. And please try to stay informed, and we'd be delighted to have you speak to this again. We have David Eichler in North Pole. Can you hear us, David?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dave Eichler from North Pole. I'm a volunteer state director for the Convention of State Projects, of whose resolution you have before you, and want to speak in favor of that. And a little disappointed you're not planning on passing out of committee today, but since it's planning on being heard and held, I'll withhold any further comment at this time.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for your work. All right, I'm going to set this bill, resolution aside. We'll take up SB 98, VPS arming of VPSOs. Who's here to present this on behalf of Senator Olson? All right. All right. Brief at ease. For us, SB 98. It's the A version. We have the A team. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. Senator Olson is in another committee. He sends his regards and thanks you for hearing the bill. The bill before the body, SB 98, it's a one-page bill, and it's easy to understand, and the new language prohibits the Department of Public Safety from not allowing VPSOs to carry firearms. SB 98, it should also be noted that since this bill and the companion and other body were introduced in the last session, the Department of Public Safety has undergone a process to write the regulations to allow the arming of VPSOs. They are, I'm not sure exactly where they are in the process. The last I heard is they were at the Department of Law, I heard, but maybe DPS could answer that question for you. Then the intent of SB 98 here is to clearly establish the legislature's intent that VPSOs would be allowed to carry firearms. And under this legislation, VPSOs would be those VPSOs equipped with firearms would have to meet all satisfactory training standards. And just to be clear, the passage of this bill would make the state support for this policy clear and unambiguous. I think we all remember last year, in the middle of March, there was a VPSO who was shot and killed in the line of duty out in Manicotic. And it's also a reminder of that there's a 1986 incident where a VPSO was also shot and killed in the line. VPSOs, they work often without backup in remote locations, and where a call to state troopers can mean hours or even days depending on weather and whether they could have backup. And the sponsor of this bill, my boss, believes that it's just not reasonable to ask VPSOs to walk unarmed into situations that pose obvious dangers to their lives and the lives of other Alaskans. And it's the sponsor's hope, and it's the intent of this bill, that arming these first responders in rural Alaska will have a deterrent effect that makes not just the officers, but the communities as a whole safer. It's also important to note that neither SB 98 nor the new regulations that are in the process now would require VPSOs to be armed. And so I guess I'll say that again. This bill would not require VPSOs to be armed. And the wishes of individual communities and the nonprofits or the Northwest Arctic Borough that also administers the program, it will be respected. And everybody should have, and DPS has been great with this, and everybody should have a thorough understanding of the issues if we are going to arm these men and women who are in the front lines of public safety and search and rescue and fire and even medical. They have medical training as well. So turning to something else here, the arms training, we've spoken with DPS and specifically Captain Arlo, who is the head of the VPSO program and training for state troopers. And the firearms training that VPSOs will receive will be absolutely identical to the firearms training that state troopers and municipal police officers receive. It will be identical. And it will also be the same instructors. It will be at the same place. It will be in Sitka at the training academy. And this training will meet the Alaska Police Standards Council and Alaska Law Enforcement training requirements. The training would cover the entirety of the use of force continuum. And it emphasizes avoiding the use of deadly force. There's a term of art within the law enforcement world where they call it verbal judo, but it's kind of little. So we changed it to de-escalation training just because verbal judo sounds funny to me. and it's a technique used to try to diffuse situations so that. The use of arms is unavoidable, and VPSO training would also intensive scenario-based exercises, and the emphasis will be on judgment and avoiding the use of deadly force. Turning to psychological evaluations, officials at DPS anticipate that the regional nonprofits will agree to a requirement for full psychological evaluations for VPSOs to carry firearms. The psychological evaluations will be identical to those administered to state troopers and municipal police. And the requirement for the psych evaluations can be added to the department's contracts with the nonprofits and Northwest Arctic Borough. The cost of each evaluation, we have done some research, and it's about $400 per person. Also, other screenings that they VPSOs will have they'll have a doctor's examination, they'll also have full criminal background checks, both statewide and national, using even FBI resources. The reason I bring that up, Mr. Chairman, is that there's been concerns through the process here through the committee process that the firearms training for the VPSOs would not be thorough and comprehensive. There's also been concerns about the level of psychological evaluations of VPSOs that carry firearms, and so that's the reason I'd like to bring that up. We also, you know, we have every assurance from the department that the 600 total hours that current VPSOs training, combined with additional arms training, will produce safe and conscientious officers. There is a fiscal note associated with the bill. It's a, the sponsor would characterize it as a modest fiscal note, and the department can answer specific questions on that. I'm also available for any questions.
Questions from the committee? Yeah, well, why don't you stick around, and I suspect there'll be some more.
Yes, sir.
Senator Diesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under our additional material tab in our folder, Mr. Scott, I see it looks like some drafted regulations, drafted amendment to 13 AAC 96040B Bravo, and I'm looking here at number 6, looking for a written report if the VPSO has to draw his firearm. I see permissive language here. It says may permit a VPSO to carry a firearm. These must be drafted by public safety, huh?
Through the chair, Senator Diesel, that's correct. These are the draft regulations that we had we asked for them, and the department gladly gave them to us.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair? Thank you. And then also in that same tab of additional materials, I see 13 AAC 96080 basic standards. And these are adopted regulations that, from what you've described, sounds like will kind of be revisited, probably beefed up a bit.
Through the chair, Sonny Giesel, I don't want to speculate. I think DPS can answer that question. I don't want to lead you down on a wrong path.
Thank you.
Every time you speak, re-identify yourself. We've got the A team here doing our help, but it helps them as they're transcribing. A question I want to get answered during this process is, in general, government employees and public safety officers have sovereign immunity protecting them from lawsuits. Would the employees that are VPSOs that are employed by regional or corporations also have some protection like that?
Mr. Chairman, if you look at the fiscal note, one of the it's under services, and there would be an additional cost of liability insurance of $500 per VPSO.
Or the regional corporation? Or for the state?
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, it's the regional corporations, but are the regional nonprofits who administer the program. That's my understanding, but that's a great question for DPS.
All right. And let the record reflect, we've been joined by Senator Wilkowski about 22 minutes after the hour.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologize for being late. I had a previous commitment.
All right, and we were going to take up your bill, but we'll come back to it. At least I want you to get introduced today and answer the committee's, and then we'll take it up again soon. All right, any further questions? All right, I'd like to have the folks from public safety, the troopers, come up and join us, please. Colonel, please join us. Please identify yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I'm Terry Vrabeck, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I'm James Cockrell. I'm the Director of the Alaska State Troopers and the Director of the Alaska Wildlife Troopers.
Congratulations, both of you.
Thanks, sir.
You're a colonel. I call you, sir. All right. Appreciate any testimony from either or both of you on the direction we're headed here.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just do a couple follow-up questions and let Colonel also speak. There was the question that just came up about the liability that is mentioned in the fiscal note, and that is for the nonprofits, for the respective individual VPSOs. Of course, there's liability in everything, as you know, and that is why if the legislature does pass this, we will, of course, take this very seriously in the type of training that goes to the respective VPSOs. And we have the we have an incredible staff down in Sitka. Prior testimony, we've talked about that, and I'll be glad to talk about anything that you have questions about the academy. Colonel?
Through the chair, committee, I guess I'll echo what the deputy commissioner says. I think if you look at how we treat or train our people with firearms, I feel we have adequate safeguards in place to provide the training necessary for the VPSOs. I just spent last week going out west through Bethel, Imani, St. Mary's, Antioch, Dillingham, talking to the VPSOs plus the nonprofit up in that area, and there seems to be universal support for at least allowing the arming of the VPSOs or giving them that option. I think if you look at the issues that the VPSOs are currently addressing in their villages, we're seeing an increase in assaults, including the VPOs, and I think at least that gives them an option, the community an option to decide if they want to have an armed VPS. So I want to everybody understand that it's going to be up to the nonprofits and the actual communities. And when we were up in Bethel, that was one of the things that they stressed is they're going to negotiate with each village to decide what villages would have an armed VPS. So. And so again, the department supports the bill and will ensure that there's protections in place to ensure the safety of the VPSO and the communities they're served.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little unclear about, and I appreciate you coming to testify, and I support the concept of the bill. My only issue is on the training aspect of it. But are VPSOs considered state employees, or are they employees of the nonprofits? Can you explain how that relationship works?
You want to answer?
Through the chair, they are not state employees. They do go to our state academy, the VPSO academy in Sitka, but they are employees of their respective nonprofit organization.
Are VPSOs indemnified by the state or by the native nonprofit for any liability associated if the VPSO does use deadly force?
And through the chair, I think that's part of, is noted in the fiscal note, that's where that additional liability insurance costs are coming up, because there is potential liability that would be borne by the respective nonprofit corporation. I think anytime we as a state agency do any type of training and programs, is there potential liability there? I'm not an attorney, and I can't speak to legal advice, of course, but I would say that's why we must make sure that we, anything we do, whether it was with a VPSO or a police officer or a trooper, that we ensure that the training meets the highest standards, and then that protects us respectfully with some of the liability.
Would a VPSO potentially be criminally prosecuted if the use of force was not justified under Alaska law, and could there be civil responsibility if the use was not justified?
Through the chair, again, I can't speak as an attorney, but I think any time any officer takes any action, we're all held accountable and must be able to justify our action. So potentially, I would say, yeah, that is possible.
And I guess what I'm trying to get, is there a difference, and maybe there is someone from law, Mr. Chair, I don't know, but I think this is an important point to at least get clear on the record. If VPSOs would be treated differently than troopers, for instance, who are state, work for the state, in terms of criminal prosecution and in terms of civil liability, do you know if native nonprofits would be criminally liable for the actions of their VPSO employees?
And through the chair, I wouldn't be able to actually answer that question. I would say that respectfully, and Colonel, you may want to comment on this, but any any use of force action, or in this case, if we were talking about the use of deadly force, would be investigated with any department, local, state, in this case, VPSOs, if that was the case, and our department does that internally itself for any type of use of deadly force, and it's fully investigated, and I think we do a very good job to justify that respectfully to the public. Colonel, any comment on that?
Through the chair, members, if we had a situation where a VPSO used deadly force in the village, whether it was justified or unjustified, the Alaska State Troopers would be the lead investigative agency and the only agency, investigative agency. So it would be thoroughly investigated. And then, as we do with our trooper cases, the regardless if we felt it was justified or not, it still gets reviewed by Department of Law, Office of Special Prosecutions. They review it to determine if it was justified or not. So we wouldn't be determining agency. It would actually Department of Law. It would clearly be investigated by the Alaska State Troopers if we had a use of force issue there, as we do now.
Could I follow up on that question? Yeah.
Senator Coghill.
So in your training, these types of expectations on using deadly force would be folded in within the training for those VPSOs? That there would be, upon use of deadly force, they would be required under these circumstances to follow through that. And then, so individually they would know it, and then my guess is the corporations that would be hiring them would also understand those things. Is that part of the training?
Through the chair, we also, and for some of these more internal processes with the VPSO program, we might defer to Captain Arlo, Senator, for yours. And I believe I think we have Captain Arlo online.
Yeah, he is indeed.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good morning. This is Captain Ross, Stephen Arlo with the Department of Public Safety.
Would you like to speak to the question, sir?
Sir, could you just repeat the question?
Sure. It was actually a follow-on to Senator Wilikowski's question on the liability. And my question on when you do an investigation upon the use of deadly force, whether it was justified or not, do the people who are being trained, are they trained on the expectation that that is going to be the case upon using deadly force? And do our contractors or the corporations who will be doing the hiring, do they understand that process as well? Is that part of the training?
Mr. Chairman, this is going to be new grounds as far as educating the nonprofits on the firearm component. So we haven't gone down that road at the academy. The use of force and the law issues associated with being a law enforcement officer are covered. With regards to the process of what would happen if a VPSO used force, just to clarify a little bit, as the Deputy Commissioner and Colonel said, just like in any other state, the process would be that we would investigate it through the Alaska Bureau of Investigations, go out and treat it like a crime scene until all the information and evidence is collected. That process gets written up and then reviewed by Office of Special Prosecutions, and they'll determine independently whether there was a criminal act involved or if it was justifiable. And at that point, that information would most likely, I would assume, be shared with the nonprofit, since the nonprofit is the employer of that VPSO. If there's any civil litigation that were to follow after the potential criminal, they'll have that information to use in a civil case as well. The VPSOs, they'll be briefed on things to anticipate with the responsibilities of carrying a firearm, just like any trooper law enforcement would be in the state of Alaska.
Okay, that helps. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I think the Ms. Dyson, the gist of Senator Coghill's question is, are the regional corporations, the nonprofits, going to understand that they may incur some liability and the process that will happen if a deadly force is used? And I think Senator Coghill and certainly all of us would really encourage you all to make that very clear to the corporations that that's going to happen.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Senator Wilkowski to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe with Captain Arlo, I had a question. I know you did a presentation in, I believe it was the House Finance DPS Subcommittee, on the reasons that VPSOs leave the program. And my understanding is that about 30% leave because of violation of rules or laws. Am I reading that correctly?
Through the chair, sir, there was a component of about half of the program had issues with either policy violations or personal judgment calls where they violated either the law itself or some policy. And majority of the policies are, most of these nonprofits have a strict zero tolerance for the use of alcohol in the dry villages. And if a VPSO gets caught doing something like that in the village, importing it in or using alcohol in the village, that's grounds for termination by the nonprofit. We do have a good portion of our terminations occur because of those issues. I think it's a combination of probably about 25 to 30% for the policy violations, and then about 20 to 25% for the criminal activity.
Wilkowski, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One concern that I have is that we are creating a private police force to enforce the laws of Alaska, and these VPSOs who are now arming and giving, essentially the duties and responsibilities of a trooper just don't have the training to do that, or the background checks. You've got a 30% turnover because of violation of rules or laws. Is there anywhere else in the United States where you have private police forces that you're aware of?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Senator, I think our VPSOs are very specialized. As you know, their academy is over 600 hours, and it's more than just law enforcement. Sure, a portion of their job is law enforcement, but as you look in their communities, and I think respectfully, I don't know who you have online to testify, but I did see some people in the audience that would totally support of how much they love their VPSOs for the type of officers they are. But they do search and rescue, they do medical, they do firefighting, and yes, a portion is law enforcement. Obviously, this was a program set up for the rural areas decades ago, and I think you'll see many of the nonprofit organizations love having their VPSOs.
Let me just be clear. No, absolutely no disrespect on my part towards the VPSOs. What I'm saying is I want to see the best possible trained officers that we can get in these villages. What's the pay for a VPSO versus the pay for a trooper, for example?
And through the chair, I don't have exact numbers. Of course, there is a difference on that. Our state troopers are paid more. Different job, different capacity. Through your help several years ago, the VPSO salaries were raised. I think it's a great job, and some of them do very well with it. So I don't have those exact numbers for you. Of course, we can provide that. The training they get is extensive. The 600-plus hour academy is well over what the requirement is, even for Alaska Police Standards minimum for a police officer. Granted, it's some different training involved in there. And granted, our trooper, our police and trooper academy is over 900 hours. But the minimum for the state is 400-plus hours right now. So we exceed the training already with VPSOs as well as the other police academy that we run. And this, of course, is going to increase the training hours more. And if you have certain numbers, please let me know, and I'll get our legislative assistant to help us get you any information you need for those if you're looking for numbers.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I think part of the question that Senator Wilkowski was getting to is the corporations are doing the hiring, and that is a private entity, and yet they're a community-based entity as well. Many of the places don't have municipalities that can actually handle these. So it is a village, but it's also a private entity. And so that puts us in a different question altogether. So this is unique to Alaska, is the way I understand it. Without community support, would a corporation be able to move forward? I guess that's probably what we're looking for, is how does the communities either support or not support this? Because the corporations are probably the best economic venue, but they're certainly very, very different than if you would have a municipality under Title 29. So maybe that helps us get to the question on whether certainly the state is partnering with them, but if it could be called a private police force, I don't know that we could say that exactly. So I think that was how we're trying to figure out, with this unique circumstance, are communities really the in charge or not? So or is the state the really in charge or not? It looks like we manage it, but with the unique circumstances of Alaska, we've tried to figure out a flexible way. But I think call it a private police force is something that we need to clarify. I don't see it necessarily that way, but it certainly is a partnership.
And through the chair, Senator, the VPSOs are considered peace officers in the state. Obviously, they do have law enforcement authority. Captain Arnold may be able to explain that a bit further. Obviously, they are employees, as we've discussed, of the nonprofits. We do, of course, besides train them, of course, we also assist with the backgrounds and in the screening of those officers. And you are also correct in the fact that it's very unique, I think, to Alaska with our rural areas. And I kind of would defer at this point to Captain Arlo if he'd like to comment further on that.
We're going to run out of time here, and I've made a commitment. Captain Arlo, this is Dyson. Most of the villages I've worked in western Alaska, there's problems with bears in the dump. And what do you do about village public safety officers having to protect people or run bears out of the dump? Are they allowed to have a shotgun then?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, absolutely. Currently at the academy, we do train VPSOs how to use a shotgun properly, just for that reason, because as you stated, the bear problems are a problem in the villages. So they already have the authority to use a shotgun. They also have the authority to use a firearm in emergency situations. And I'd just like to go back to clarify, VPSOs are already doing this job. They're already enforcing the laws. They have a full peace officer status around the state. The only thing we're actually introducing is another tool to do the job. So nothing's going to change regarding that already function that they hold. And as including the nonprofit, the liability is already there. If they could potentially take a life with their baton or other instruments needed to protect themselves, if they had to, we're just putting an additional tool on their tool belt.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone here or online that wants to speak against this bill? All right. Brief at ease. Back on the record, we're going to hold this over. Senator Wilkowski has an amendment. If we get through 182, we may come back to it and so on. So I suspect the votes are there to pass this bill out. And those of you who want to speak in favor of it, I'm sorry we didn't get you in today. The bill probably won't need your testimony in order to get out of the committee, and we'd be glad to get it in writing or by email and so on. And I apologize. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, committee.
Colonel, so are these guys going to get the Gen 4 Glock 20s?
Glock 22s.
Okay. All right. And it's intriguing.
Did you want to go offline?
Yeah, we're off the record, I thought. All right. 182. We heard from the administration on this. It is my intention to get through 35 or 40 minutes of public testimony. I've asked those who are here to kind of do a little triage and make I think they have at least three people representing from each of the unions here. Would you all come up, and would one of you grab another chair to so you can get all three of you here?
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for coming and helping us.
Thank you for having us.
Please identify yourself for the record, and then you can give us your testimony whatever order you choose. And let's identify yourself, the person that's going to speak before you do, and then we'll also have questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ben Goldrich. I'm the representative for the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Ron Brissett. I'm the representative for the Masters, Mates, and Pilots Union, the union that represents the licensed deck officers aboard the Alaska Marine Highway System.
And good morning for the committee and the chair. My name is Rick Diesing. I'm the regional director with the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific Alaska region. I'm a 32-year retiree from the Alaska Marine Highway System. Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I appreciate this opportunity to testify this morning on Senate Bill 182. The members of our three unions are your constituents. They're your brothers and sisters, husbands, daughters, neighbors. Senate Bill 182 will result in roughly a 10% pay cut for MEBA members across the board. It penalizes our members for being Alaskan citizens. COLD has been a part of our wage for 30 years. COLD enables our members to live in North Pole or Anchorage and pay their own way to their change ports, which may be in Juneau, Ketchikan, Homer. But it enables our members to live all across the state. COLD was intended as an incentive for mariners to move to the state of Alaska, and it's been a success. The overwhelming majority of our members live in the state of Alaska. Senate Bill 182 targets only those members living in the state. It puts us in a strange place to be in front of you today and talking about COLD when we're actively in negotiations with the state of Alaska. Early on in negotiations, we heard from the administration that COLD was a concern for them, and we have been negotiating in good faith throughout in an effort to come to a mutually agreeable conclusion. If Senate Bill 182 passes, you're asking us to negotiate out of a hole. Senate Bill 182 is a concern for us because all of our bargaining units have holes in them, so to speak. We run anywhere from a 7 to 10% vacancy rate for the Masters, Mates, and Pilots. It's closer to 20%. And for the IBU, Regional Director Giesen can speak to that. We're trying to bring young mariners into the state to live in our communities and to work their careers on the Alaska Marine Highway System. Removing COLD from their wage is not going to do that. It's going to prevent us from being able to bring young talent into the state, and we're going to lose those with years of experience. At a time when wage really is all there is now, a 10% pay cut is just a killer, and it's a big hit in for Marine Highway employees' morale. We ask that that you not pass Senate Bill 182. It is targeted strictly towards Alaskans, and we ask that you continue to allow us to negotiate with the state of Alaska in good faith. Thank you.
Thank you. The questions for the Black Gang, I mean the engineers. Senator Diesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Goldrich, I'm looking here. Could you tell me, it says here chief engineer wage is $40.62 an hour in Alaska, plus $677.96 non-watch pay. What is that? What is non-watch pay?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. Non-watch pay is a payment that they receive in lieu of overtime. A chief engineer generally works a 12-hour day depending on which vessel he is on, but the reality of that is their day could be 18 hours. Non-watch pay is intended to was based on, I believe, 11 hours of overtime pay, although they work far beyond that each and every month.
Could I ask a follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Sherman. So it says $677.96 PP. So is that per pay period? And how many hours is that? Is that like a blanket amount, or is it based on the number of hours of overtime? Could you help me with that one?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. It's a flat amount that they receive per pay period, regardless of how many hours they work.
Thank you.
Further questions? Please stand by. Let's hear from the skippers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ben spoke very eloquently about our...
Identify yourself for the record,
me.
Please.
Ron Bursette, representative for the Masters, Mates, and Pilots Union. My cohort, Ben here, he spoke very eloquently of the issues that are of concern to all three of the unions. Masters, Mates, and Pilots represents the licensed deck officers of the ferry system. MEBA, which Ben represents the licensed engineers. So our efforts pretty much go hand in hand. Our issues are the same, and what Ben just said speaks eloquently for the Masters, Mates, and Pilots in addition.
Sir.
Rick Diesing, Regional Director for the Unlicensed Employees with the Alaska Marine Highway System. I concur with both my brothers here sitting at the table that this is an issue that will harm all Alaskans that work in the state of Alaska. We have 640 members, and out of the 640 members with the IBU, 5% of ours are from out of state. If we are to go on and have this cut, it is going to harm the lifestyle of every one of our members. It will harm their communities with the money that is brought in to their communities through their paychecks. It could harm the ability of them sending their kids to college. It could harm the ability of many, many things coming down the line. There would be no enticements coming for people to come to work for this system, seeing that this wage cut, and it's like, well, they're first responders in the first place. They're all firemen, they're all medical rescuers. Any emergency that happens on the vessel, our employees are the ones that are the first ones there to help you. Middle of the night, you're cruising along, you're sound asleep in your stateroom, that fire alarm goes off, you hear abandoned ship, we're all there. All of our employees are trained and they're retrained. They go through so many different upgrades in their ability to even be able to work on the Marine Highway System in the first place. So just to get a job, even as starting off as a dishwasher, you have to be a firefighter, a medical responder. You have to be able to be crowd control. You're a policeman. I mean, there's 12 different hats to wear when you're out there. And unlike the shoreside jobs, you have your job there. On a ship, you have many, many jobs. So what I would like to say is that you know, this is something that would definitely harm our members, and we speak against it.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we talked a little bit about this last week, and as I understand this, there's some old contract language, which basically, and it's like 40-year-old contract language, right, which basically says the base rate is based on assuming you live in Seattle. It's based on a Seattle rate, but we're going to give you a cost of living increase if you live in Alaska, right? So is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, that would be accurate.
And so if you take away the cost of living adjustment, what you're doing is you're giving every Alaskan, every member of your union who lives in Alaska a pay cut, while the people who live in Seattle or outside of Alaska keep their wage the same. Is that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, that's the way we see it.
All right, thank you.
Senator Cargill.
Just on that point. So this is a new world to me, so I'll ask probably the dumb question first, but it said that the cold was set in 1977. What is the differential then and now is probably one of the things I'll have to figure out.
If I may, through the chair, Senator Coghill.
Identify yourself.
I'm name. Sorry, Ben Goldrich.
Yeah,
The differential was set between Seattle and Anchorage. Nowadays, it's the state's contention that the cost of living in Seattle and living in Anchorage is roughly the same. And that may be true if you live in downtown Seattle, where housing prices are sky high. But if you're comparing the cost of living in Talkeetna to living in Everett or Marysville, it just doesn't add up. It's still vastly more expensive to live in the state than it is to live in the lower 48. Unlike other unions, other state unions, our members do not receive step increases. What we get is our negotiated wage, the wage we get at the table, and our members across the state have based where they live, based their living on their wage, and that includes the cold. And so when Regional Director Deesing spoke about the fact that this is going to be harmful for our members living across the state, it's absolutely true. Our members base where they live, base their budget on their wage, and a 10% wage cut is a huge hit for our members.
Cargill to continue.
Just rounding up my knowledge on this. So if the it just seems to me like a 1977 level probably isn't going to work. So wouldn't it be more advantageous to be able to negotiate that, or do you think you need to have a hardline standard to work off of when it comes to the differential? Because, as you said, the geographical issues are pretty dynamic.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, it's complicated. I think cold is a better fit for the Marine Highway System. We do not get geographic differential. That is a negotiated item. It's not been offered up by the state of Alaska, though they've spoken about it. It's not something that that we currently get. And starting from a minus 10 and then asking for geographic differential may benefit some members, but where they live and where they work are largely two different things. Our members who work on the Fairweather for the most part live in Juneau. Our members that work on the day boat Chiniga that live in Cordova reside in Cordova when they're working, but for the most part they don't live there.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be clear, you're in negotiations, all of you, with the
yes.
with the administration right now. And if the administration wanted to come to the bargaining table and try to renegotiate this provision, is there anything that would stop them, could stop them from trying to do that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, absolutely not.
All right. And we'll have please.
If I could, through the chair, yesterday,
your name?
We were Rick Deesing, regional director with the Inland Boatman's Union. Yesterday, as we were in negotiations, cost of living differential was a topic at the table with this going on in this committee. And it's very baffling. It's, you know, we're trying to negotiate in good faith. We're trying to do the right thing. Our members are very passionate about this, and I'm sure a lot of you got phone calls from all over the state of Alaska yesterday. You have a member in North Pole that is one of our members. We have members in each of the communities throughout the state of Alaska, and they're very, very passionate about keeping the benefits that they have and serving the Alaskans with the best ability that they have been doing since this was established 50 years ago. It used to be called a proud tradition, and then throughout the years, for some reason or the other, they took away a proud tradition and just left the Alaska Marine Highway. I believe in my heart, my soul, I put 32 years into this system. It is a proud tradition. We want to continue to make it a proud tradition, serving Alaskans the way Alaskans be served first rate. Thank you.
Sure.
Through Mr. Chairman, I wanted to speak to Ben Goldrich, excuse me. Wanted to speak to one of the concerns that we heard from the state. And our Alaskan members receive cold. One thing that was brought up was investigations into non-residents receiving cold. It is true that our members have to apply for cold. And to the best of my knowledge, and I've only been here for 12 years or so in this position, we've had one arbitration for one member who applied for cold. The state disagreed with that. We used the mechanism we have in our contract to resolve disputes, and that's going to arbitration. We lost that arbitration. We paid the arbitrator fees, but that's the mechanism we have to deal with these disputes. If there are other people out there that are receiving cold that ought not to be receiving it, it's the state's responsibility to take hold those members up, to take them to task. But so far, we hear about the state's concerns, but the reality of it is only Alaskan members are receiving it.
Senator Wolskowski,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just say that this, I mean, it's some unusual language that you have in the agreement, and it dates back a long time. But we always talk about Alaska Hire in this building, and we always talk about how we want to encourage people to live in Alaska, hire Alaskans. It's actually a pretty clever way to do it. You set the base rate at over 48, and then you pay Alaskans more. It encourages Alaskan hire.
Through the chair, Senator Wolskowski, it works.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do want to encourage Alaska Hire, and it looks like, based on the information I have, there's substantial benefits to living in Alaska outside of the cold. I'm looking at vacation. If you're an Alaska resident, 420 hours of vacation compared to a Washington resident, 160 hours of vacation. Sick. 180 hours. This is per year leave after 5 years of service. 180 hours if you're an Alaska resident, 96 if you're a resident of Washington. So that looks like a pretty significant benefit for Alaska residents in addition to this cold differential.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, in the Master's Mates and Pilots contract with the state of Alaska, there is no difference between Alaska residents and out-of-state residents as far as vacation accumulation or sick leave accumulation is. The only difference for sick leave accumulation, everybody gets the same thing. For vacation accumulation, there's a difference based on when you were hired. If you were hired by the state before 1985, you are able to work up to a maximum amount of hours. If you were hired after 1985, then you're eligible to work up to a maximum number of hours. But there's no difference in our contract for vacation or sick leave based upon your place of residence.
Lisa, continue.
I will follow up with the state on that. That's very different information than I was given. Thank you.
Right, and Senator Wolskowski, my understanding is that parts of the negotiation is prescribed because of this law in 1977. And the administration, I think, will represent to us as they are bound by that and can't violate it and put it on. And my understanding from the administration, we'll get them back here, is that you all will get something like the other state employees do with a geographical differential that goes on, and we'll get them back up here to talk to that. And I think I heard you say it's just recently even showed up in the discussions.
Mr. Chairman, if the state's going to offer up geographic differential pay, we're looking forward to hearing it in negotiations, sir.
And I may be mistaken. And my understanding is the administration is cognizant of the fact it's going to be a pay cut, and if indeed that keeps our pay and benefits from being competitive and being able to keep you guys on the job and happy, that'd be hopefully something that they're wise enough to address. We're gonna run out of time here, and I've got two or three pages of folks, and as I told you earlier, I worry about that. What I'm going to do is, you guys had a big bite of the apple here. I'm going to go to two people who are online and come back. Is there anyone else here in the room that wants to testify? Okay, and so I'll give you guys a bite here. I'm going to ask everybody to keep it to 2 minutes. And if please don't repeat what's already been said unless you feel it's very necessary. So you guys can stay there. Or maybe vacate a couple of chairs. David Alderson in Ketchikan, are you there, sir? All right. Chris Owen in Palmer?
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Dyson. That's Chris Olson in Wasilla, Alaska, yes.
Please give us your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Dyson. My name is... And for the record, my name is Chris Olson. I live in Wasilla. I am the chief engineer on the Alaska State Ferry Laconi, homeported in Juneau. I am a member of MEBA. Thank you for all the hard work that you and your committees do, and thank you for all the opportunity for me to speak on this issue. I am testifying against Senate Bill 182. This bill penalizes me for being an Alaska resident. I have been an Alaska Marine Highway crew member for 18 years, first as part of the IBU, and the last 10 years with MEBA. I relocated to Alaska in 1986. I have chosen to live in this great state that I have grown to love. It is my opinion that there is no comparison between the Maritime Union's cold or the geographical difference for the other regular state Alaska unions. The two are completely different animals and unrelated to each other. Senate Bill 182 is specific only to the Maritime Union's coal payment, which is what I will address in my further remarks. The coal payments that Senate Bill 182 proposed to do away with were instituted by law in 1977 to reward Alaska Marine Highway employees who choose to live in Alaska, thus keeping the Alaska wages within Alaska, supporting the Alaska communities. By removing the coal payments from the three Maritime Unions, this bill, while making no difference in the wages for the non-Alaska residents, will be penalizing the AMHS employees who do reside within Alaska. These employees, Alaska residents, are your neighbors, your friends, your constituents, and maybe even your family members. The study that was cited for justifying this bill compares the cost of living between Seattle and Anchorage. It is my opinion the study is a flawed. As Mr. Goldrich had said, not everybody's going to live in Seattle, and there's far cheaper places to live outside of Seattle should this coal payment go away.
Can you summarize?
For me personally, my wife and I are both State of Alaska employees. My wife is eligible for retirement but has chosen to work a few more years. Should Senate Bill 182 pass, it will most certainly encourage us to rethink our early retirement and relocate to a place with much lower cost of living. We currently live in Wasilla, and I commute to Juneau for my work assignment every 2 weeks. These travel costs are not paid for by the Alaska Marine Highway. These costs come out of my own pocket. Should I choose to relocate and live out of state, I will still commute every 2 weeks with my job at the Marine Highway, and my travel costs are comparable with what I'm paying now.
Thank you, Chris.
I urge you to reconsider Senate Bill 182 and not move forward with it. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thanks, Chris.
Patrick Phillips, are you in the room? All right.
I'm on the phone.
Yeah, all right. I'm sorry, Patrick. Please give us your testimony.
Hi, my name's Patrick Phillips, and I live in Juneau, Alaska. My wife and my children live in Juneau. And I work on the motor vessel Fairweather. And I think a lot's been said, and so I won't try to repeat any of that. I'll just say that I moved to the state 20 years ago, and I love my job, and it's a great job to drive the ferry. I think it's important. I like serving the community and bringing people where they want to go and doing it safely. I would just say that when I moved to Alaska, I knew it would be more expensive. I knew I'd need snow tires, a snow blower. Going to the hospital is pretty expensive. But that I saw the deal, it was in the contract, and that was the deal I was signing up for. And I feel like Bill 182, you know, punishes me, and it kind of changes the deal, you know, when I took my job. So that's all I have to say about that. I just, it'll be a real hardship to me, and that's all.
Yeah, thank you. All right, we'll go to the first person on the list. Let's see, for Juneau folks. Do we have a Juneau guest list here? All right, we'll go there. While we're waiting here, we'll go to the next person, Jared Barlow. Are you online, sir?
Yes, this is Jared Barlow.
Please identify yourself and give us your testimony. Try to keep it at 2 minutes, please.
Hi, my name is Jared Barlow. I live here in Quawaq, Alaska, on Prince of Wales Island. I'm a family of four. I'm a member of the IBU Union. And I'm the OS on the A crew for the motor vessel Kennecott. I steer the boat, tie up, and let go of the lines, park your cars. I'm speaking today against Senate Bill 182. I believe this is going to hurt me along with the associates that I have on the boats with us. You're talking about taking away the cost of living differential. I'm trying to figure out why there's or how you can say that there's not a cost of living differential between living in Alaska and living in Seattle. But as just me, myself, I see that there's transportation costs. Living on Prince of Wales Island, there is no good dentist here, so in order to go to a dentist, I have to go to Ketchikan. It costs me $100 round trip to go ahead and have one person, let alone if I take my kids over there in order to go ahead and see the orthodontist to go round trip. We don't have specialist doctors like ear, nose, and throats or allergist doctors here on the island. So it costs me to go ahead and take my family to get medical help, to go to Ketchikan or go to Sitka or go to Juneau, to wherever we need to go to. When I travel from Prince of Wales to go to work over in Ketchikan, I look at the gas prices. The gas prices themselves are 10% difference, or 10 cents difference. It costs me more, 10 cents more here on Prince of Wales Island than it does in Ketchikan. If it's going to cost 10 cents more, then obviously either the gas is cheaper in Ketchikan than it is in Seattle because I'm paying the same price as Seattle, or I'm paying 10 cents more than Seattle. There's a difference. And it's along with another cost of living that happens to me as a parent, as an Alaskan resident, is high school sports. This year was a traveling year for my team. I have a 17-year-old who's a junior in high school, and I missed out on most of his high school basketball games. I'm going to be able to see four of them. The last one's going to be homecoming this Friday. I don't get to see sports because I can't travel with my team along with all the other parents. The cost of living in Seattle is if you want to go to your high school sports, you get in the car and you drive. The district might be maybe an hour or two drive away, but all you got to do is get in the car and drive. It's not going to cost you $400 or $500 to take your family to go watch a sporting event. If you're trying to compare bananas with bananas,
can you summarize,
yeah,
please,
might
sir?
Be the same price.
Can you summarize?
I'm almost there. I'm sorry.
Way over time.
if the price differential is not, then you'd have hundreds of roads to nowhere connecting all the islands and all the communities, and you wouldn't have a ferry service. So obviously there's something that there's a cost differential. Thank you for letting me speak.
All right. Thank you. Teresa Gilbert.
Good morning. My name is Teresa Gilbert. I work for the Alaska Marine Highway on the motor vessel Kennecott in the capacity of chief steward. So I supervise all the stewards on board who do the cooking, the cleaning. There's a lot of things involved in this job. For me personally, I am a single person purchasing a home in Juneau. And with the wages that I have, that's how I set my budget, how I was going to purchase my home. And so if I get a cut in pay, I mean, it's going to be detrimental to me. I have about 3 years left before I retire, and I want to stay in this community. I love Juneau. It's my home. I've been here since 1980, 30 years on the ferry system. I've worked 30 years there. And to take this cut in pay would just be a big hit for me. I bought a car locally. I prefer to buy locally if I can. But if we get this cut in pay, I know a lot of places down in Seattle that are so much cheaper than here. And I may be forced to use other alternatives to do that. But I certainly prefer to buy local, stay here. I want to stay here after I retire. So everything else I wanted to say was already said. So thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
We want you to stay, too. All right. I'm going to close public. Well, keep the public. Anything more you fellas want to say?
Mr. Chairman, I think we've probably covered it.
All right. I have about 9 pages here, and I hope you can sympathize that very, very difficult to get all through those. In this, we're delighted to hear get your testimony in writing. This is not the last committee that this bill will see. It'll have a long and somewhat tortured process, and we'll have to go through the House as well. So this is not the end of the day. All right, I'm going to have the administration come up. Please stick around here. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Nikki Neal, the Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations.
And I'm Kate Sheehan, Deputy Director of Labor Relations.
All right, so you've heard the questions that come up, and certainly the question is if cold goes away, and then all these people are going to take a significant hit. It looked to me from the figures that some of the up to 18,000 a year that will go away. We've also heard the question that the Alaska residents will be discriminated against because they won't get something, and even though they have a higher cost of living. And also the accusation that indeed there will be no geographical differential as many other Alaska state employees get. Would you speak to those three issues at least, and any other one you heard come up here that we need further informing?
Mr. Chairman, I can start with the bargaining piece. Our interpretation of the bill as currently written is that we would no longer be able to negotiate a cost of living differential. We are currently in negotiations, as you have heard, and we have had discussions about the cost of living differential as well as the geographic differential and what we can currently do. The study has indicated that there is no cost of living differential anymore between Seattle and Anchorage that it is at base. That's what we're basing our figures off of. And actually, the 2008 McDowell study used a national study to come to that determination. So we are in the process of having the conversations with all three unions about geographic differential, what we did with the other unions when we implemented the new geographic differential rates, alternatives we can use if cold is taken away and we have a pot of money, so to speak, to deal with what we can do. So, yes, there are ongoing negotiations and discussions on that topic.
I'm thinking. So when you use the word cold, you mean this term of art that's in the statute, but this bill passes, you're going to still be able to make adjustments based on where people's jobs are or where they live as the standards that we're using for other employees?
Mr. Chairman, it's more difficult with the Marine units because they can live wherever they choose to live. They generally work a week on, week off, or 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off schedule, so they can choose to live in a place other than their change port. We do have three day boats in Metlakatla, Juneau, and Cordova, so certainly that's a little more clear. But we are having discussions about things we can do. The geographic differential, of course, is for the different cost of living within the state of Alaska. The cost of living differential in statute was inside and outside the state.
Yeah, all right. I've got that. All right, on the other two issues I mentioned?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, can you remind me what the other two were? I'll take notes this time.
Yeah, certainly the implication of the testimony we've heard is that passing this bill just means that probably $8,000 to $18,000 cut for all the people around. And I hope you can look me in the eye and say that's not the state intention. In this negotiating process, there will probably or undoubtedly be an adjustment to keep our salary benefits hourly competitive.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Nikki Neal for the record. If we are to gain agreement through collective bargaining, we do have options, and I believe some of those have already been discussed verbally with the unions, and that as when we negotiated changes on the geographic rates within Alaska, there was some protection for current employees where that were getting that higher rate of pay. Their pay was not, they did not see a reduction in their pay. So there are certainly options available that we're open to discussing with the unions through the collective bargaining process.
All right. Further questions, comments? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You probably don't have it right in front of you, but I can read you the language. It's from the Masters, Mates, and Pilots Collective Bargaining Agreement, of which you are a party. You're a part of that, right? Expires. It's currently valid, right? Section 1702. This is something that you negotiated and you agreed to. It says, it is agreed that the cost of living differential between Alaska and Seattle, which is referred to in AS 2340210, shall be a mandatory subject for collective bargaining and shall not be changed, modified, adjusted, redetermined, or altered in any way by the state of Alaska unilaterally, and no change shall be made without the consent and agreement of the union. Is that what that section says?
If I don't have it in front of me, like you said, but I trust that you're
Is that the section that you negotiated?
At one point in time, yes. Many okay. years ago, that was negotiated.
And that's the section that's currently valid today as you sit here?
Today, yes.
Okay. And you're violating that section?
I have to, through the chair, I have to disagree, Senator Wilkowski.
Explain to me how that's not an unfair labor practice.
We're, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we're in negotiations currently with the unions. This legislation is irrespective of negotiations.
This says the COLD shall not be changed without the consent and agreement of the union. Do you have the consent and agreement of the union to change the COLD? I heard unanimous testimony that you didn't. Did I miss something?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we're currently, this is a topic that we are currently bargaining. as Nikki said, irrespective of the legislation, the bill here, we are bargaining cost of living differential. We're talking about geographic differential. The whole contract is open for negotiations. So I would respectfully disagree that we are violating the contract or that it is an unfair labor practice. We're at the table. We're having those discussions.
Senator Coghill.
So the way I understand it, statutorily, you're bound by the COLD presently, right?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, yes, we are.
And so if this law changed, it would only be on prospective bargaining agreements, is the way I understand it. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, yes, that's our interpretation.
And Senator Dyson invited you to come comment on this particular bill.
Through the chair, yes.
All right. So I don't know that it's bad faith for them to come comment on a bill that would change a prospective bargaining. I think the unfortunate thing is you're right in the middle of bargaining. So,
and I understand Senator Wilkowski's point is not that these people discuss it, but indeed that it's a part of the negotiation in contrast to the law and so on. Is anyone here a labor attorney?
Yeah.
All right. That's an important question. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold this bill over. I want somebody from the administration to have a labor attorney here, and they can have a spirited discussion with Senator Wilkowski, indeed, about the issue that's raised. And I have the question. I'm sympathetic to the bill, but I have the question about having this law pass while they're in the midst of your negotiations, you know, and that issue. And so we'll take that up when we come together. And for all of you who didn't get to testify, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to let you do it. But we'll take all your testimony in writing or by email, and we'll make sure it gets into the packets. Apologize. Just the way that we've got to do our business here. So we'll set aside this bill. Brief at ease. How do you all?
What bill was that again?
The
98. The VPSO bill? Okay, got it. Would you take a brief of these, Mr.
Staff?
Yeah, who do you want? On the record, Senator Wilkowski. Senator Olson apparently would like to speak to your amendment, and he can't be here, so we're going to hold it over.
Okay.
But please distribute the amendment.
Yes, I will.
All right. Seeing that, appreciate everybody's presence, particularly the members of the union. Delighted at your interest in public affairs.
Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Oh, yeah. And we're adjourned at 10:26.